Previously on Beta.
Coming up, how to deal with your nervousness as a new skydiver or whenever you're about to jump out of an airplane.
Why are millennials incapable of achieving connection?
And what exactly does ballet bring to this or any other story?
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, crime novelist Megan Abbott takes us through the twists and arabesques of her riveting ballet yarn, The Turnout.
I was one of those girls that tried to take ballet class and sort of failed miserably, but the sort of enchantment of the ballet stuck with me, and it's sort of the exotic nature of that life.
Also, Green Bay's Kristen Radke explores loneliness in her new graphic nonfiction book, Seek You.
I do feel like writing a book about loneliness made me a less lonely person because I came to understand how prolific loneliness is, how universal it is, how many people experience it, which is pretty much everyone.
But first,
maybe it was a Bichot Beaujolais, 1970, but in an AM upstairs on Crescent Avenue, I had a conversation with K.C. Byrd. We were discussing rhythm, and I said, rhythm makes everything move, the seasons swing. It backs up the elements, like walking Paul Chambers' fingers. My worthy constituent, Byrd said, the universe is a spiraling big band in a polka-dotted speakeasy, effusively generating new light, every one-night stand. We agreed that nature can't do without rhythm, but rhythm can get along without nature.
That's Ishmael Reed reading an excerpt from his poem, Rhythm in Philosophy. Ishmael is a Renaissance man. Besides being a poet, he's also a novelist, essayist, songwriter, playwright, and a jazz pianist. Ishmael's probably best known as a satirist. He often examines American politics and culture through novels like Mumbo Jumbo, The Terrible Twos, and Conjugating Hindi. Ishmael has earned 2 nominations for the National Book Award and 1 for a Pulitzer Prize. He's also received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. One of Reed's most important innovations was Neo-Hoodoo. He took the spirit of the African religion Vodun and combined it with contemporary issues in America.
In the 1960s, black writers departed from imitation. For example, James Baldwin was influenced by Henry James to the extent that he wrote a critical piece about Henry James' work, and Henry James' son sent him a portrait of his father. Of course, Henry James was a wannabe Anglo because he tried to smother his Irish background. He's a terrible anti-Semite at the same time. And if you read Ralph Ellison, he also is indebted to Hemingway and Eliot, although I found nothing in The Invisible Man that traces him to T.S. Eliot. But I think he had to say that in order to gain admission to the club at the time. 1960s, black writers broke with that. I mean, they began to study Arabic, the indigenous African languages. I went into something called, black folklore, using that and trying to put a postmodernist bent or a slant on black folklore, and people went into other different directions trying to find something that was more connected to their roots. Amir Baraka was a genius at that because he, abandoned the so-called eloquence of the language and wrote in the style of the streets, of street talk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which you have been doing for a long time as well.
Well, I mix it all up.
Right, yes. A couple of years ago, you wrote a play called The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda. Can you tell us a bit about the play and why you wrote it?
Well, I thought that the presentation of Alexander Hamilton on Broadway didn't square with my research. And I think, although I got a lot of criticism for the play by those who were Hamilton fans, Hamill fans, they call themselves, the discussion was begun by 3 women historians, Lyra Montenegro, Nancy Eisenberg, and Michelle DuRoss, especially Michelle DuRoss. She takes on those historians who put out the myth that Hamilton was some kind of abolitionist. One by one, I said it reminded me of George Foreman on the afternoon that he fought 5 opponents at one time. It's devastating. So the women historians were the ones who began the argument. I merely staged the argument. And so the point of the play was that, although it was criticized by people who hadn't seen it, especially on Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR,
mm-hmm.
really subjected to ridicule, even though they hadn't seen the play.
A writer named Ishmael Reed really hates the musical Hamilton because he says that by making Hamilton himself a cool hip-hop verse-dropping immigrant hero, it covers up Hamilton's real life as a slave owner and generally bad guy. So Ishmael Reed wrote a play called The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda, in which the author of Hamilton, played by an actor, that's the most beloved musical of modern times, is he's visited by ghosts of people from history telling him how wrong he is. That's the play. In the end, of course, we guess he'd be visited by a ghost of Lin-Manuel Future, who says, "Don't worry about all this. I am so rich."
And so my point was that all of us are misled by the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And that even though Lin-Miranda had used that one book as a basis for his play, there were other sources that he could have consulted. Even Ron Chernow says that Hamilton might have owned slaves. Now, since then, the Schuyler historical site, his father was Philip Schuyler, the general in Albany. They published a piece that was repeated in the New York Times, or republished in the New York Times, that he indeed owned slaves,
mm-hmm.
and bartered slaves. So I thought that I would respond to this billion-dollar production with a sort of like a rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, is there one real historical fact that isn't covered in the musical, that something about Hamilton, something maybe that he said that really kind of really bothers you more than anything else, aside from the fact that he owned slaves?
He was into private property.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his ideas that formed the bank. The bank, Thomas Jefferson said the bank was not meant for farmers, but was meant for the rich, the 1%. But he said that he accused the British of stealing Negroes from their owners. So he, in his writings, he sort of like ranks blacks along with cattle and horses, like farm property equipment.
Yeah.
And there's very little about his attitude toward Native Americans. Both he and Washington believed the Native Americans should be exterminated. And I ran across a letter that Hamilton wrote where he congratulates the vigilante mob for massacring a Native American village.
Hmm. How have audiences responded to your play, The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda? And also, I'm curious, have you ever received feedback from Lin-Manuel?
He hasn't answered my criticisms or the criticisms of the play, but the play has been published by Powerhouse Books, which is a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster, and is doing very well. I think it's number 15 bestseller on the list of musicals.
Well, that's great.
Musicals and plays. So they have a billion-dollar enterprise going on here. I think we spent about $50,000. So it's a real David versus Goliath conflict. And when the Disney thing happened, we followed them all over the world.
Hmm.
Europe, China, all over. Whenever they mentioned the Disney version of Hamilton, they mentioned our rebuttal.
Hmm. You're part of the longest continuing music poetry collaborations. They're called the Conjure Projects. How did this come about?
According to Kip Hanrahan, he wanted me to write a text for Cecil Taylor and Brezhnikov, the dancer. And that was supposed to be the collaboration that Kip Hanrahan was going to arrange. But I think something happened where I think Bill Gunn was supposed to direct, and I think somebody said that they wanted more power or something. It fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Kip Hanrahan did, there were some songs and poetry from my second book of poetry, Conjure, that he sent to noted musicians like Alan Toussaint and Taj Mahal, Carla Bley, Steve Swallow, and David Murray, and invited them to write compositions to go with the poetry and the songs. And that's how the first Conjure event came about. There was a concert at the public theater, and then after the concert, the first album was produced, Conjure 1. And since Conjure 1, there's been Conjure 2, Conjure 3. We did performances in Europe. We did a tour of Europe and performed at the Blue Note in Tokyo.
Wow. As you mentioned, your poems and lyrics have been set to music by such great musicians as Taj Mahal and Alan Toussaint. And one of the poems, one of these poems is called When I Die, I Will Go to Jazz. Can you tell us a bit about this poem?
I was replying to Ted Jones, whose famous poem is Jazz is My Religion. And if you go to YouTube, you can find that poem. I tried to duplicate the rhythms of jazz on the page, and it's got a sort of like a metaphysical question, whether you want to go to paradise or whether you want to go to a place where there's like 1,000 years of jam sessions.
Yeah, exactly.
People tell me that this poem is read at funerals.
Oh, that makes sense.
Of jazz fans.
As Ted Jones would say, let them go to heaven or let them go to hell. When I die, I want to go to jazz. Who needs Gabriel when we got Clifford Clark, me and Dix? You can add Thad to that distinguished mix. And Prez and Billy sit on their thrones in their courtwear pork pies, gardenias, and checkered vests. And the tempo of the place is like Denzel Best. With Mingus and Brown doing the chores on bass. A place where Satch is Avatar. And Sun Ra, Gil, and Count are resident sages. And among those on trumpet are Fats and Hot Lip Sage.
This poem has been sort of like framed on a wall by the SF Jazz Center.
Hmm.
And it's in an alley next to the Jazz Center on Franklin that's called Raise Up Off Me Alley. And Raise Up Off Me comes from the title of the memoir by Hampton Hawes, a pianist, a jazz pianist, who was in Lexington Prison Hospital, and he's pardoned by JFK. I think JFK said all the guy wants to do is play jazz.
Are there any particular musical pieces from the Conjure Project that you think really strengthened the messages of the poems?
One of my favorites is Alan Toussaint's Skydiving.
Mm.
That was really a poem that was really therapeutic for me. I was going through a difficult, dark time, and that poem sort of like rescued me from that despair.
In these downhill days of a hard-hearted decade, shedding through the world our tales on fire, you can't always count on things opening up for you. Know when to let go. Learn how to fall.
You're a Renaissance man, a novelist, poet, essayist, songwriter, playwright, jazz pianist. How does your work in these various genres cross-pollinate from one medium to the other?
Well, I think I was telling Carla Blank, who's my partner for 50 years the other day, that my writing plays has strengthened my ability to orchestrate scenes in my novels. It's like I'm able to bring in different sensory things like sound and other things that you learn from writing, seeing plays being performed and writing plays. So I think they sort of overlap. Sometimes a poem will tell you that it wants to be a novel. So Flight to Canada, for which I coined the term neo-slave narrative, I wish I'd never done that because now it's become a big industry. That's sort of. So Flight to Canada was a poem. It began as a poem. And then when I studied the poem, I said, well, you know, you got a novel here.
Mm.
And so the poem is the first writing that you get in the novel.
Yeah. Did it take you very long? Did you write the whole poem before you decided this should be a novel, or did you get just partway?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did. The poem is based upon a letter that one of the fugitive slaves wrote when the master tells him to return to the plantation. He tells him what he can do and where to go, and what he can do it himself. And so that's that was the basis of the poem.
Yeah. Your former student, Frank B. Wilderson III, has written a book called Afro-Pessimism, and he makes the case in the book that there is something essential about the suffering of Black people that can't be reconciled with the suffering of other people. I'm curious to know, what do you think of Frank's idea?
Well, I think he's got a point there, that, you know, multiculturalism has become to mean everybody but Blacks. Mm. You know, what Frank Wilderson is saying, I believe, is that you can't rely upon what he calls the junior allies. Whites are not the only racists in this country. You know, mm-hmm. There are racist attitudes that are embraced by a number of communities, which are, on the surface, seem to be in alignment with Blacks. And I wrote a novel called Conjugating Hindi, which didn't receive very many reviews here. I discussed that. The novel's about a conflict between a Black sort of like liberal professor and a right-wing Indian public intellectual. As a matter of fact, I told Jack White. Jack White wanted me to write something about the Rodney King beating. And he wanted me to write something for Time magazine. What happened was we had fax machines and one page was missing, so he had to write it himself. But I told him that in 20 years, Blacks will look back to miss the days when white racism was the only racism they had to worry about.
In your novels, you've often accurately predicted the future. So what do you think the next few years here on planet Earth are going to be like?
Well, I see nothing but pessimism. There just seems to be an inability to grasp the peril that the Earth is in. I mean, of course, the Earth will continue for, you know, at least maybe another billion years, but it may not be continue with this species. And I'm just wondering, is there some kind of death wish in our DNA that would have this happen? And so my new story I'm writing, it ends with one of the characters speculating about the future of the Earth. The character talks about the UN report that talks about approaching the point of no return. Mm-hmm. And the character says, well, the problem with the report is that most of the leaders of the world can't read. This is kind of leadership that's, you know, just taking the world to ruin.
Yeah. Yeah, very well said. Ishmael Reed, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. It was a real pleasure and such an honor. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Ishmael Reed is a poet, novelist, essayist, and a playwright. You can find out more about Ishmael and his work at wpr.org/beta.
Whenever I'm having a bad writing day, I tweet out that picture of John Turturro from Barton Fink, where he thinks like the wallpaper is peeling off the walls of his hotel room.
Megan Abbott joins us to talk about her latest novel, The Turnout, which takes us inside the competitive world of ballet. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Their mother told them stories of older girls hiding broken glass in other girls' shoes, which sounded like a dark fairy tale. But was there any other kind? Ballet was full of dark fairy tales, and how a dancer prepared her point shoes was a ritual as mysterious and private as how she might pleasure herself. It was often indistinguishable.
That's Megan Abbott reading an excerpt from her latest novel, The Turnout, a gripping and suspenseful story set in the world of ballet. And as that reading indicated, ballet isn't all adagio, allegro, and arabesque. It can be very cold-blooded, cutthroat, and competitive. I wasn't expecting this book to be so compelling, because when it comes to ballet, I don't know a pas de basque from a pas de bourrée. But of course, I should have known better. Megan has crafted another propulsive thriller that explores family connections, femininity, sexuality, and power that will keep you reading until the wee small hours of the morning and beyond. She joined us from her home in Queens to talk about why she finally set a thriller in the world of ballet.
I had always imagined that one day I'd write about it. It just is a world that's always fascinated me. You know, I was one of those girls that tried to take ballet class and sort of failed miserably, but the sort of enchantment of the ballet stuck with me, and it's sort of the exotic nature of that life. But I just didn't have the story. And then I started to think about the studio I attended was run by these two sisters. And they're very different from the sisters in the Turnout, but we just imagined all kinds of romantic and interesting possibilities for them as we sort of stood in class and tried to do our moves. And so I started to think about what it would be like for two sisters who run a school together, and it sort of came from there.
Hmm. Can you talk a bit about the research that links ballet and the concept of effortless perfection in women, and also how you weaved this idea of effortless perfection into the characters in your novel?
Yeah, I guess I was thinking about why I connect to ballet and why many women do. And there is this notion in ballet of, you know, you're supposed to be this sort of ethereal being, this sort of graceful creature that glides across the stage and seems to move through space so easily. And part of that is that you're supposed to look like it's so easy. Of course you can do this. And sort of hiding, masking all that exertion and the physical toll and the blood, sweat, and tears that are involved to make your body do that. And you started to think about that in relation to women in general. There's this sort of facade that a woman's supposed to always put on, and she's never supposed to let them see her sweat and to be able to take on everything and just sort of be the people pleaser and the achiever. And I think so many women get caught up in that. I know I have. There's a sort of tyranny in it. Maybe ballet is partially required because of the precision, but I think for the rest of us, it can really exert a toll.
Mm-hmm. I understand that your book was inspired by listening to the Dirty John podcast. How did that podcast influence the Turnout?
Yeah, it's funny because there was no ballet in that, listeners might remember that it was very popular when it came out, but it was about this sort of serial predator who is, has no relation to the book, but of women, and he would romance them and brutalize and rob them blind. But was really interested in the response to it. And, you know, they always say never read the comment section, but I was really, really intrigued by all this anger that I saw in it, directed not at the serial predator, who in fact is a murderer, but at the women who fell for him. And it was very angry that how could you be so stupid? All the red flags were there. And just started to think about what that was about. It felt like a kind of way of pushing something away and saying, that could never be me. I would never do that. It was like almost like trying to stave off something. And so I really wanted to explore that dynamic. And in the novel, you know, it's to have one of the sisters, the older one, Dara, be very judgmental of her younger sister Marie's sort of romantic choices and try to figure out what that's like from the inside, how one might come to feel that way and why.
Yeah. The Turnout finds the Durant sisters preparing their students for the school's annual performance of The Nutcracker. It's fascinating how the story of Tchaikovsky's ballet echoes the plot of your novel. How did you come up with that idea to get that kind of synchronicity going?
It was a bit of sheer luck, I have to say. I picked it for very practical reasons, which is that most ballet schools, that's their moneymaker for the year. And that's where they, not just the ticket sales, but really as a recruitment tool, because, you know, all those little girls like me who sit in the audience 1 year's Nutcracker and then want to take ballet classes so they can be on stage the next Christmas. So I picked it because of that. And it's because the one ballet that people have seen, if they've only seen one, that's the one. But then it turned out to be so perfect and sort of unfold all these other resonances, as it really is a female coming of age story. And in some sense, Dara and Marie, the sisters, though they're adults, are experiencing a coming of age as they've been so nestled in their family home and their family business that they've never really entered the world of true adulthood. And that is sort of the journey in The Nutcracker. And there are darker elements of The Nutcracker, too. I read the original story and I was able to tease out some of that, too. The E.T.A. Hoffman story is really a kind of dark and, let's say, very Freudian fairy tale. And there was some good stuff in there, too.
Yeah. The relationship between Dara and Marie and Dara's husband, Charlie, is very complicated and very layered, very intriguing. How did you go about developing these characters and the ways they relate to each other?
Yeah, that I was really interested in those kinds of families that are so insular, you know, like you can sort of, you know, when you, let's say you go to someone's house and they have that kind of family, you don't even know what they're talking about. It's all inside jokes and inside, passive-aggressive hostility, and all these things are flying by you and you don't really know. And how those, you know, every family has, everybody has a role in it and a way that they're typed. This is the spoiled brat. This is the bossy one. This is, and how you can't escape those roles. And even if that you're not that way to anyone else in your life, that in your family you are, and how that can become stifling, as it is, I think, for Dara, Marie, and Charlie, that it's so extreme in their case, as so they've lived in their family home for their whole lives, and they've worked in their family studio, so they really have these sort of twin castles that they move between. And so this sort of these roles and rituals and insularity has become stifling, and something's got to break.
Mm-hmm. And something does break, yeah. You have several books, films, and images from movies, songs, and photos that you use to build the story worlds for your novels. What specific things influenced the turnout?
It was really, I do love to look at photos, and they're really sort of transporting, and I was looking at a bunch of them for this. It started with these sort of very beautiful photos of ballet, but it was really also some photos of Sally Mann, the photographer, took of her children that sort of in her idyllic, I believe it's West Virginia. I could be wrong about that, but it's in nature, her three children, two girls and a boy, and this, how beautiful they are and how they're sort of playing together and is sort of swooning and romantic and lovely. And then on the other side, I started looking at a lot of these Deanne Arbus photos, and she took these wonderful, people may know her, she's more famous for taking photos of creepy twin sisters. Mm-hmm. And her photos can be quite dark and disturbing, and I love them. But I was particularly interested in these photos she took of carnivals. And in the book, there's all these sort of memories that Dara has of going to a carnival with their dad, and of the fire eater and the sword swallower. And Arbus has some great photos of that. And I remember going to this St. Joan of Arc's carnival as a kid in my hometown, and this, how exotic it felt, and seeing these women do these sort of, you know, glorious eye popping feats had a big impact on me. So they were also really, really absorbing, and lots of Todd Hedo and Gregory Crewston, who do these sort of beautiful, sort of ominous suburbs at night. That was another big one.
Yeah. As I was reading The Turnout, I couldn't help but think about Darren Aronofsky's film, Black Swan, and also the Shirley Jackson novel, We Have Always Lived in the Castle. Were those two pieces of work, were those influences on you at all?
Yes. Black Swan, I almost had to work against it, you know, because I was so affected by it when it came out. And I remember when it came out, I thought, well, I can't do a ballet novel for a while. So I waited a decade. it's so striking and sort of haunting. And I know a lot of ballet dancers hate that movie because it sort of, they feel it sort of indulges in certain stereotypes, which sort of always happens when you enter a profession or a world, but it's still inescapable for me, because it's sort of so sumptuous in the way that it explores female psychology through the dance. So that was certainly one, but really the bigger one is the Shirley Jackson novel. That's one of my favorite novels of all time. Mm-hmm. And it, like, even if I'm not thinking about it, still it feels like it got in there without me even knowing it, because it's so, you know, a family that has never really left home and is very insular and has its secrets. So obviously I'm always sort of going back to Shirley Jackson. You know, people may know most or know her from The Lottery, her famous short story, but her novels are incredible, and that's my favorite.
Most definitely. Yeah, and that really kicked in for me that this was obviously an influence. Quite late in the book, the line where Dara says, "We've always lived here. We've lived here our whole lives." And then I realized, oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Shirley Jackson, yeah. Has writing The Turnout changed the way you think about the world of ballet and also this idea of effortless perfection?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of that effortless perfection is going away, in part because you can't hide the toll anymore. There are cameras everywhere, and these are public figures like in nowhere before. And they're also resisting it. They're saying, you know, my mental health matters. And I think that's all good and wonderful. And all that is inspiring. But I also think writing it made me appreciate the experience of ballet even more, because I do see the toll and the cost and the sort of, oh, does one have to do this to do that? You know, there's a part where it goes too far, but I suppose it's the passion that these dancers bring. I watched this wonderful documentary called Restless Creature, which is about Wendy Whalen, who was a famous New York City ballet dancer in the Balanchine mode. And she, this was a documentary about being forced to retire in her late 30s and then going through these surgeries. She couldn't even walk for a while. And she said, if I don't dance again, I will die. And it was the only moment like that in the documentary, but you knew that she really felt that. And one could say, well, how could anyone think that? But I just found it very moving that despite this sort of what she had been through, it was worth it to her. And not only that, but she wanted to keep going. I mean, so I suppose that glamour quotient has not left me. I do find that passion for one's art really kind of beautiful.
Hmm. Yeah. I understand you're developing The Turnout for a limited series. What can you tell us about the development process?
Yeah, I've been writing it and as a sort of 8-episode limited series, and it's really it was really weird because usually I've had a year or so after the book comes out that I have adapted some of them, and this time it was right after finished the book that we sold it to a studio, and so I had to sort of think about it differently very quickly. In some ways it was easier because it hadn't set in my head as long. Mm-hmm. I could start to think about it visually and think about the visual storytelling, but it it's a really great moment for these limited series. I think we have a hunger for them, and with the sort of saturation of TV choices, I think there's something that we all want to get swept away in something for 6 or 8 weeks and not have to worry about finding it again for the next season. So
exactly. And I'm looking forward to seeing who plays the various characters, because they're so richly developed, and you know, I have images of them in my head, as I'm sure all readers do, and it'll be interesting to see how closely or not closely the actual cast members match the images of the characters in my head.
Yeah, that I love that. It's often a schism, you know. Mm-hmm. It is always hard when you've read the book, but when it comes together, it's the sweet spot.
Yeah. You're also working on a new novel. Is there anything that you can tell us about that?
Yeah, it's sort of early days. Mm-hmm. It certainly feels like me, but I am moving away from, for the time being at least, the athletics and into something a little more personal.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's worth pointing out also, though, that your previous novel, Give Me Your Hand, was not set in the world of
That's
athletics.
Right.
It was set in the world of academia, yeah.
That's right, the life of the mind.
Exactly, yeah. Barton Fink, John Goodman will show us the life of the mind.
So, yes. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's the best movie for writers because it really conveys all the sort of terrors of the process. Whenever I'm having a bad writing day, I tweet out that picture of John Turturro from Barton Fink where he like the wallpaper is peeling off the walls of his hotel room.
Yeah. Yeah. Megan Abbott, thank you very much. Congratulations on the turnout, and I'm looking forward to the limited series, your next novel, and everything else that you're working on.
Oh, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
Megan Abbott is the author of The Turnout. You can find out more about Megan and her novel at wpr.org/beta.
It's one of the things that just kind of happens slowly over time. Like, you just have these holes you're not really sure how to fill, and then all of a sudden you know what's supposed to go there, and it kind of feels like a miracle.
That's graphic artist and Green Bay native Kristen Radke. She joins us next to talk about the impacts of loneliness. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Traveling makes you lonely.
I'm alone. I am not lonely. You?
Are you lonely?
That's a clip from the movie Heat, featuring Robert De Niro and Amy Brenneman. It begs the question, have you ever been alone but not lonely? Have you ever felt lonely in a crowded space? Is your idea of loneliness defined by characters you see on screens, like De Niro or Don Draper on Mad Men? Graphic novelist Kristen Radke set out to tackle those questions. Her latest book is called CQ, A Journey Through American Loneliness. In it, Kristen combines evocative artwork with intimate and thoughtful prose. The result is a comprehensive cultural history of loneliness in this country. Kristen herself was born in Green Bay, but currently lives in New York City, so she's well aware that those two distinct areas can lead to different kinds of loneliness. Kristen joins us now to share dispatches from what she learned on her journey through American loneliness and why she decided to take it.
I can't really remember the moment that I became interested in loneliness. I just became, I guess, like slowly obsessed. I started writing about loneliness in 2016, which I think was a lonely year for a lot of people. And, I was also, through my research later, I learned that loneliness traditionally spikes at three ages, your late 20s, your mid 50s, and your 80s. And I was in my late 20s. So it was sort of this moment of transition. And I think I was just thinking about isolation and then kind of accidentally started researching and studying it.
How did you come up with the title CQ?
So CQ comes from ham radio. So when my dad was a kid, I learned in adulthood he was really into ham radio. And when you make out a call on amateur radio, either using your voice or using Morse code, you make what is called a CQ call, the letters C and Q. And that just means you're kind of reaching out to anyone who's there, anyone who's listening can answer. It's kind of just like a call out to across the waves for anyone to answer. And over time, people took the letters CQ to stand for Seek You. And that's how the title came to be.
Yeah, it's a great title. That works perfectly. How did the arrival of the pandemic in 2020 affect your writing and illustrating?
It's a great question. I think time will tell. I do feel like a massive imposed isolation where we were kind of all under the same guidelines and we all had to be separate from each other in the same way if we were taking it seriously. Is different than the concerns of chronic loneliness. And so I think it was easier for us to talk about because we were really all in the same boat. But in a regular year, loneliness is one of the reasons I think we don't talk often about loneliness is because it feels shameful or personal. And the pandemic really destigmatized loneliness. I think it remains to be seen whether or not that will continue to be the way that we look at loneliness or not.
I'm curious about your creative process. What do you come up with first, the illustrations or the writing?
Usually the writing. I usually come up with the writing first. I'll write a little bit and then start to draw from there because when I do draw, it does kind of change my relationship to the text because I might be able to draw something that I'd written and then I don't need to say that anymore. Or the drawing may bring up, some new questions that I have about the text.
What kinds of things did you do visually to convey loneliness to your readers?
It's not so much tricks as it was about like trying to override my default, which is like sometimes I would do things like I'd be like, I can't draw another person alone in an empty room. You know, like there were certain like visual tics I think I had to override in order to create a book that was like varied and was approaching loneliness visually from different ways.
Mm-hmm. Was that tough to do, to overcome your visual tics?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's one of the things that just kind of happens slowly over time. Like you just have these holes you're not really sure how to fill. And then all of a sudden, you know what's supposed to go there. And it kind of feels like a miracle.
Yeah. You grew up in rural Wisconsin and then you moved to New York City. How did being suddenly surrounded by so many strangers affect your feelings of loneliness?
It's an interesting question. And I don't totally know. I mean, I did find I was a pretty lonely kid. I think a lot of children are lonely. I think there's like something kind of alienating about being a kid because you're kind of trying to figure out your place in the world and what your life is going to look like, which I think is a kind of painful, lonely moment. So I don't know. I mean, I think I'd always kind of loved cities and always gravitated towards cities. And I really love Wisconsin. I come back and visit a lot, but I think it didn't feel like a jarring transition in terms of loneliness. I mean, I think anytime anyone moves, there is kind of that period where you're trying to get your feet on the ground. And when I interviewed people for this book about loneliness, a lot of people cited a move, like a geographical move, as one of their loneliest moments.
Yeah, that would make sense because, yeah, as you alluded to, there's this sense of dislocation and starting all over
exactly.
again in a different environment. Yeah, I was really struck by this sentence that you wrote in the book. Perhaps we see loneliness in others simply to feel less lonely ourselves. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. I mean, I think when I started this project, it was because I was observing people who were alone in public settings, which is something you can really do a lot in New York. I mean, people in New York spend a great deal of time alone, and then you're kind of stuck together in these spaces like the subway or in, you know, restaurants where a lot of people are eating alone, which is something I didn't see a lot of in Wisconsin. I think we tend to gather in a different way. One of the reasons that I think loneliness is so painful is because it feels as though you're the only one feeling it. Like you feel alone while everyone else is connected, which is of course not true. It's a complete fallacy. But I think I do feel like writing a book about loneliness made me a less lonely person because I came to understand how prolific loneliness is, how universal it is, how many people experience it, which is pretty much everyone. And I think that there's something about that kind of destigmatizes it for us and helps us feel a little bit more connected.
Mm. Well, yeah, that makes total sense. What is the difference between aloneness and loneliness?
Well, solitude and loneliness are often conflated and they're not the same thing. Like someone can spend a lot of time alone and never feel lonely, and someone can be in very crowded spaces all the time and feel alone. You know, it's the old cliche of like never felt more alone than in a crowded room. But solitude is just a state of being, and loneliness is more of a state of mind. So every single person has a built-in biological threshold for how much loneliness or aloneness that they can tolerate. And so certain people are more predisposed to loneliness than others, which is why a lot of people can live alone and feel completely content, and why someone else maybe needs to have a lot more interaction. It's a little bit related to like introversion and extroversion.
Mm-hmm. How hazardous can loneliness be to our health?
Loneliness is extremely dangerous for our health. And when I say loneliness, I'm talking about chronic loneliness, so experiencing loneliness for a period of over 7 years. But chronic loneliness is surprisingly detrimental to our health. It's one of the things I didn't expect to learn when I began this book, but it was startling. I mean, so in certain studies that have been conducted on people who identify as lonely and people who don't, people who identify as lonely tend to die 7 years sooner than people who identify as socially fulfilled. At first, it was believed that, well, if you live alone or if you spend a lot of time alone, it was called the social control hypothesis, that if you live alone or you spend a lot of time alone, there's no one there to be like, don't eat that cheeseburger, or like, we should go for a walk, or like, you should get some sleep. Like there's someone there kind of policing your habits. But over time, they discovered that the disparity in life expectancy between people who spent a lot of time alone and people who didn't was too significant to attribute it just to those kinds of individual behaviors. So our bodies are actually just less effective when we're feeling disconnected.
Yeah. How did the arrival of the internet affect the way you personally experienced loneliness?
you know, I was born in the late 80s. So I was one of those people who early in my life didn't really have the internet. And then as I was kind of coming like into preteen era, you know, I was 11 or 12 or 13, the internet really became a part of my life. And it did really change my relationship to the world. Like my relationship to like chat rooms or like early blogs or something like that gave me, you know, access to people far outside of where I lived, in the same way that like my dad calling out on ham radio as a kid in the 70s gave him access to a kind of a network of strangers. And so I don't, you know, there's a lot of talk about like what the internet does to us in terms of isolation and how it positions us against the world or makes it difficult for us to connect with one another. I think a lot of that kind of remains to be seen how true some of that will be. But for me, I think as a kid, it did really help me feel more connected.
You write very eloquently about media coverage and its relationship with loneliness. And you talk about television's portrayal of male protagonists like Mad Men's Don mm-hmm. Draper and The Wire's Jimmy McNulty. How does TV's portrayal of these kinds of characters influence the way we think about loneliness?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think one of the things I was investigating in this book was America's relationship to loneliness and how it depicts loneliness sort of through media, through our storytelling, because that's so much of how we understand the world is by the stories that we're told. And that happens, you know, since childhood. And so to me, I see those characters as just renditions of cowboys. Like the cowboy myth is a huge part of American ideology. And it's all predicated on someone being alone. Like it's a man who rides off into the sunset by himself. And there's something very like alluring about that character. And I think that it's also wrapped up in like ideas of American individualism, which I think are equally dangerous. But it sort of creates this character that isn't entirely realistic, but it also it prizes individualism and isolation in sort of an alluring, attractive way that I think is a little bit dangerous to the way that we should actually relate to one another.
The subtitle of your book is A Journey Through American Loneliness, and it makes me wonder, how does American loneliness differ from loneliness in other countries? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, so America is not the loneliest country in the world, but it is up there. So there are other countries that experience high levels of loneliness, like England, certain countries in Scandinavia, Japan. But we are one of the loneliest countries in the world, and I think we haven't done a lot of work to figure out why and figure out how to bring each other closer together. And, you know, like in the UK, they've been anointed like a minister of loneliness, and they have a lot of outreach programs and stuff like that for people who are experiencing isolation. In America, we haven't really done that work. But it is quite interesting to look at the causes of loneliness and how they differ across the world.
Emily Dickinson has one of the best definitions of loneliness ever. Can you tell us what it is and what it means to you?
Yeah, Emily Dickinson called loneliness the horror not to be surveyed, which is very beautiful. I mean, I also like the word horror when talking about loneliness, because biologically our brains actually respond to isolation in the same way we respond to a physical threat. Like our brains can't differentiate between the feelings of loneliness and feeling in immediate danger.
Really?
And the reason is because when we are lonely, we are, like, in the grand scheme of human history, it was very dangerous to be alone. Particularly when we were hunters and gatherers, we needed each other as backup to survive. So when we now live in a culture where we spend a lot, maybe we don't have those same wildlife dangers on the day-to-day, but we spend a great deal of time alone, that's one of the reasons we enter those dangerous states where our brain is putting out too many stress hormones, and then that causes a lot of health problems. But I like Emily Dickinson's definition because it's talking too about how loneliness is so much about being seen, about being observed, about being witnessed. And I think that's so much of what we need as human beings to feel safe, is to feel seen by someone.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're absolutely right. And you have this great sentence that riffs off of Emily Dickinson's quote. You write, "In childhood, we are often more surveilled than surveyed." I love this sentence.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I was talking about with the loneliness of childhood. Like, in childhood, you can't really make decisions for yourself. I mean, of course, everyone has different levels of independence in childhood. But you know, your life is sort of made up of decisions that other people have made for you, which makes you feel not whole or not, you know, and it's a necessary thing. You know, you're a kid, you're not a fully formed, your brain isn't fully formed yet. You need those social structures that are sort of putting you in place to keep you safe. But it doesn't mean that's not also an isolating experience.
The writer Olivia Lang has said that loneliness is a gift. Do you agree?
I do. I think, and I loved that. I loved her book, The Lonely
it's
City.
A great book.
I think that, yeah, it's beautiful. I think that loneliness is essential. It's important. Like, loneliness has a very important biological purpose, which is that when we feel alone, we feel threatened, and then we need to reach out to another person. We need to get back, you know, in a group. And that's really important. And if we don't feel that impulse, it's kind of like, you know, if you don't feel pain, you don't know if the stove is hot, you continue to burn your hand. It's the same thing. I mean, it's a sort of a biological warning bell. So it is a very important thing that we feel. We just need to learn to listen to it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Thank you for making that. Kristen Radke, thank you very much for joining us. It was great to talk to you, and congratulations on CQ.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kristen Radke is the author and illustrator of CQ, A Journey Through American Loneliness. Find out more at wpr.org/beta.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.
Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Ishmael Reed, Megan Abbott, and Kristen Radke. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You all have had the chance and the privilege to be enchanted, transported, and even sometimes devastated by the performances of this true artist of our company.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
But it's not like he's all warm and fuzzy.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Surprise yourself so you can surprise the audience. Transcendence. And very few have it in them.